Thanks, Jack. I'm here to give you wisdom. Really great for me to see the trailer of this documentary. It brought me back to those years. Also reminded me how important it is to bring that history forward and to bring it to people today. Not just young people, because you'd be amazed at how much people older than you have forgotten. It's very easy to forget something that even that happened. People who participated in those movements have very often forgotten about it, and that they need to be reminded of it. Even I had to be, even I had to be reminded looking at this film of what happened in those days, and to be inspired again by thinking about that. And my hope is that that the young people today are going to learn more about our history, think about those years, and think about what it means to your lives, and think about what you have to do with your lives. I don't mean that you have to go to jail every day. Occasionally, maybe. But it does mean that you have to think about participating in the movement against war, against movement for social justice. One of the things that this brought back to me was how the movement against the war progressed from Catonsville, 1968, to Camden, New Jersey, 1973. How many of you have heard of the Camden 26? there are two people here. That's almost a majority. I think of that trajectory because, the Catonsville Nine were given these jail sentences. I had been with Dan Berrigan just before Catonsville. I'd been with him in North Vietnam in Hanoi, where we were invited by the North Vietnamese to the displeasure of the United States government. But and then again, everything we did those days was to the displeasure of the United States government. Sometimes deliberately we wanted to displease them. But we were going there to actually to pick up three American flyers, the first ones who were going to be released. They're captured flyers, and they were the first ones to be released by the North Vietnamese in early 1968, and they wanted representatives of the peace movement to come and pick them up and escort them back to what it was sardonically called the free world. And so Dan Berrigan and I spent a lot of time together. I had never met him before. I'd never spent any time with a priest. But Dan Berrigan was a priest, a poet, and a person who'd been spent some time in Latin America. With the Jesuits had sent him to Latin America thinking that would sober him up. They were wrong. If you want to control somebody, don't send them to Latin America. They'll see what's going on there. They'll see the effects of U.S. foreign policy. They'll see how people are living. They'll come back fired up to do something about the world. That's what happened with Dan Berrigan. He came back. So he came back from Latin America. He went to North Vietnam, and we saw what the American war had done in Vietnam. We saw the destroyed villages. We saw what happened to the peasants of Vietnam under our bombs. When I think of John McCain as a war hero, I think of him as the person who, before he was imprisoned and badly, tortured and badly abused, before that, he dropped bombs on Vietnamese peasants. That's part of his heritage, too. Mustn't be forgotten. And Dan Berrigan saw the effects of those bombings on those villages in Vietnam. When he came back, he was ready to participate in Catonsville. So the Catonsville Nine got these jail sentences. And what's interesting is the Catonsville Nine then started a series of actions by priests and nuns and lay people against draft boards, doing what they did, barging into draft boards, trashing draft records, all symbolic actions, as Martin Sheen was saying. You know, you pound away at a nuclear warhead with a hammer, it doesn't destroy nuclear weapons. It's symbolic. And so the actions against the draft boards were symbolic actions, but they were dramatic actions. They were actions against the law. They were actions of civil disobedience. And there's nothing that excites the senses so much as acts against the law, because we brought up to believe in the law, brought up to be law-abiding citizens. And if you don't abide by the law, well, then you've created a little sensation. Very important in times of crisis to create sensations, not to stay within the law. Because if you stay within the law, you're trapped. And when you go outside the law, you raise the level of energy and excitement and protest, and that's what happened in the Vietnam years. And so there were more and more of these draft board raids. And the sentences, interestingly enough, the sentences that people got began to decrease as the war went on. They began to decrease because the anti-war sentiment was growing in the country. One of the things you learn if you study trials and judges and justice and so on and so forth is you learn that what happens in the courts, whether people are considered guilty or innocent, and what sentences they get, depends less on what the law says than on what is happening in the country. And what was happening in the country was, yes, the country was turning against the war. So by 1973, when I was called to testify in the trial of the Camden people, I had testified in a number of these trials, the Milwaukee 14, et cetera, all these numbers, you know. And they, and so here were the Camden people. This is the largest number yet. In 1973, they're caught red-handed going into the draft board in Camden, New Jersey, trashing a draft board. They're put up on trial. Now, what happens in this trial? For the first time in all these draft board raids, going from Catonsville down to Camden, for the first time, these defendants are acquitted. They're caught red-handed. They did it. Doesn't matter. They're acquitted. Why? Because the country has turned against the war. Even the judge has turned against the war. The judge was appointed by Richard Nixon. Doesn't matter. He's swept up in... He allows the defendants who are defending themselves, called a pro se defense, defending themselves. He's allowed them to do whatever they want in the courtroom. They huddle in the center of the court like a football team planning its next strategy. And the prosecution is going wild. You know, how can you allow this? And you know, forget it. The judge allows everything. He allows the mothers of the defendants to get up there and say how sweet their kids are. He allows me to testify before the jury to talk to them for 2 hours about the history of the war in Vietnam. And at the end, they're acquitted by the jury. First acquittal in all of these draft board cases going from Catonsville now. Why are they acquitted? Yeah, because of what's happened in the country. When they are acquitted, when the jury announces the verdict, the whole courtroom stands up and sings Amazing Grace, like you heard here, you hear that song, that beautiful song. The jury stands up with them and sings Amazing Grace. And the foreman of the jury throws a party for the defendants. But that's how things move, things change. I tell you this because people very often despair about things changing. The people at the start of an anti-war movement think, oh, nothing will ever happen. These people have all the power. We're never going to stop this war. No. Movements start slow. They sometimes take years. You don't know how long they'll take. You never know when you're going to succeed. You just keep on and on, as Dan, Phil, Liz, Frida, and even the people who are not named Berrigan. Lots of them, where they all continued, carried on. And so for me, you know, the great lesson about Catonsville and all that it conjures up is the importance of protest, the importance of civil disobedience, because ultimately, after people were jailed and given sentences, and after, well, they were looked down on by a lot of people, well, they broke the law. And then they broke the law, and it's okay. interesting to me being here at Boston College, because to me, Boston College exemplifies for me a change that took place. I was invited early in the war to speak to a class at Boston College by a priest who was obviously against the war. There was one at Boston College. Maybe there were two, who knows. But he invited me to speak to his class. And I spoke about the war. And I was greeted with very polite applause. You could almost hear it. That was Boston College, maybe about 1969 or 68, something like that. Then I was here again in 1972, a few years later. And this time, it was a huge anti-war meeting in the gymnasium of Boston College, and there were 4,000 people there in a great rally against the war. And that was the trajectory. I remember early in the war, I spoke at a Catholic university, and the priests there sort of invited me to dinner. Being invited to dinner by priests is something you can't say no to. And I'm invited to dinner, and they were saying, oh, the Berrigans, they shouldn't do things like that. That was early on. Afterward, things changed. I remember being invited, I had the same experience, come to think of it, that I had at Boston College at something called Newton College of the Sacred Heart. Now you can imagine what kind of school that was. Newton College of the Sacred Heart? That was a very conservative place. And I was invited by an anti-war nun to speak to her students. Had the same experience that I had when I'd been invited by that priest. You know, it's a very polite audience. A few years later, Moratorium Day, in fact, 1969, when there were demonstrations all over the country against the war. On that day, I was driving past the doors, the portals of the Newton College of the Sacred Heart, and there was a huge banner in front of the Newton College of the Sacred Heart with a huge red fist, stop the war. Things change. People change. Institutions change, even. Wars stop when people begin to act and continue acting and don't give up and don't get depressed and don't think you don't have a chance, because we've seen again and again in history the movements that think they don't have a chance. Well, yeah, they have a chance if they persist. If people persist, and you do what you can. You don't have to do heroic things. You don't have to even do what the Berrigans are heroes. You don't have to do heroic things, but little things, little unheroic things add up to huge heroic things. So I hope all of you think about your part in this. Here we are in a war, right? In a war that's been going on for a long time, in a country which is going through a financial crisis, and where the country has been taken over by the rich and corporations. Obviously, there's something for us to do. And have to think about what we all can do, even what little thing we can do. And it's not just a matter of being, you know, munificent on behalf of other people to do things for somebody else. It also means that your life will be different. Your life will be more interesting if you are engaged in social action. It'll be more interesting, it'll be more productive, you'll feel good about what you're doing. So that's all I have to say.
We'll have a little bit of give and take with the audience a little bit later. We have a few more speakers to introduce to you. One thing I want to say, yesterday I got a call that the Boston Globe had listed this event, and the title of the event that the Boston Globe listed was Christmas in a war-making state. So I really appreciate all of you who turned out, because I think some of you expected maybe Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed, maybe Nat King Cole songs in the background. So let's thank the Globe. I don't know how they came up with that title for the event, but some people say any publicity is good publicity. So now I'm going to turn it over to Boston College's own Charles Derber, and he's going to say a few words to you about Peace Heroes and possibly even about the financial meltdown. But we'll give him a chance to just draw a few lessons for you.